We're your health and safety angels, Daisy Silcock
and Lindsay Mason. Health and safety,
busting the barriers. Hello and welcome to another episode of Health and Safety Angels. It's Daisy here, and I've got a very special guest today, which I've been very excited about interviewing this gentleman. We've got Steve Kerslake, who, Steve, do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Steve Kerslake. I'm the founder of a charity called Construction Sport. I also have a business side in the groundworks industry of construction. Background's been construction since pretty much I fell out of school and landed on a building site. And to that day, I've pushed in this world. And over my own kind of journey of the past 15, 18 years, I suppose now has become very mental health and wellbeing based in the sector. So, trying to help the industry in a way to improve on the dreadful statistics that are out there. But at the same time, trying to be very honest with it and be like, well, the last 10 years we've failed, so we need to learn from our mistakes and go forward together, really. So I'm very straight up talking and clear to the point, and I like to think I talk like a ground worker in this world of mental health and wellbeing in a way. So it's very black and white in terms of making it, but I've identified a number of things myself that I personally think, even from my own experiences, but stuff I've learned in the industry that I believe if we address in a different way that we can make it better. But what I have learned is that there's a very kind of stringent kind of group of people at the top of this industry that just won't allow change, and until those people ease off a little bit and relax and allow change, I don't think we're going to see any changes, if that makes sense. So that's kind of where we are now, pushing it. I might be one person who's pushed it on my own really over the years, but I've got a good number of companies now behind us and supporting us in a way that helps us push on. But we're adamant we'll change things, and we're not going to stop. We deal direct with families who are involved in all these different circumstances, and we've seen the pain that comes of the stuff that happens in our sector. We deal with it firsthand. We speak with families and we see it all. So we're driven beyond just a job. This is passion and interest really that drives us ultimately. And to be honest, it's mental health and wellbeing what is mainly headed up by the topic of depression, and I find it bloody interesting, if that's the right to say. I just find it fascinating, and I've, over the years, found that everything we do in day-to-day life involves us being mentally prepared for things. So by studying this topic, you ultimately realise you can enough strengthen yourself and allow yourself to be ready for what is to come and deal with what is happening on the day. So that's kind of where we are at the moment. With the idea with it is we're called Construction Sport because we ultimately want to drive a sporting kind of mentality or culture into the construction sector. Not saying everyone's got to be involved, but there's just so many positives that come with sport and exercise in general. And I think that's just part of day-to-day living. You look after yourself and get involved with sport or exercise, you're already going to have a healthier life. So, the military do it. I always say this a million times, but the military do it, the ambulance service do it, the police service, the fire brigade, the banking sector, the insurance world. They've all got kind of bodies that oversee the sport and make sure that sport is driven within those industries. Now, because construction is bigger than all of these industries, we're one of the biggest out there. And we didn't, until we come along, have anything in place to push that. So, however, what we have also identified is that every construction company does have its own passion for a certain sport in its way. And a lot of the time, it's our companies in our sector that are funding a lot of these teams, be it your grassroots football team up to your professional top tier athletic kind of level, really. Look at corporate hospitality in the professional sporting world. It's full of construction companies. Yeah. I can promise you that now. I speak to a lot of the companies. They like to keep themselves undisclosed, but they're there in these stadiums watching. So we know the passion there is for sport is there, and we think that's a great way of harnessing.
Okay, so let's just pause that a second. Let's just take me back a second. Steve, you left school, and what did you do?
Again, sport probably played a part because it was my old football coach actually offered me a job. I actually got my job between my GCSEs, actually. I think he said that when are your GCSE days? And I said it was like Monday, Wednesday and Thursday. So, well, if you've got Tuesday and Friday off, do you want to come and work on a building site? And Yeah, what I didn't realise is those days were actually for revising. But I put that to one side and went on a building site. And I was, within the first 3 months of work at 16 years old, I went and got my CIS card, I think it was. You actually got a physical card. I used to go sat, I can't remember what it was now. You went into a room and it was like there's some lady sitting there. And you went through it and she gave, at the end of the day, they gave you a CIS card. And I went to Southampton, then on to Cardiff, and then up to Sunderland, all to literally go and put glazing in, large kind of commercial glass, in a lot of buildings. So that was my first taste of leaving school. I think within 1 week, my first few shifts, I was asked to carry a transformer from the van to the site. And then I realised just how hard work construction is, because the transformer at 16 years age is heavy. I don't care how strong you are. There's a lot of weight behind those things. And yeah, from there, that was mid-2000s, 2006-ish, 2007. And then I think that company kind of slipped away a little bit and I moved on. I think the 2008 recession played a bit of a part in that. And then I ended up needing work, went into my local rugby club. I play rugby, and then literally just over the next couple of years, kind of just bounced from job to job with whoever would give me a start in this rugby club. So I'd be a trainer, I'd be a, helping out the electrician or a chippy, just labouring for all these different trades. And I've done that for a number of years. Yeah, absolutely loved it, really. And I never went to work for the job. I didn't care what I was doing, as long as I was being paid. But I went more for the crack, really. It was just, especially at that age, you just want to earn your money and earn enough money to go and enjoy yourself all the time, don't you? And like I say, yeah, 100%. I remember getting, when we was up in Sunderland, we'd work for like 45, 50 quid a day and then get a sub at the end of the day for 45, 50 quid. So I ended up coming home from Sunderland with not a penny, because we'd just spent every single night we went out. But I still want to change it for the world. I think, especially that age, it's what it's about, really. Just go and enjoy it. And then life, as I've learned, gets very serious very quick when you kind of approach your later 20s and people start putting bills in the way of
And you
going
own
to
your
work.
Own company now, is that right?
Yeah, so we have construction support contract, actually. So it's a groundworks and civils kind of based company. We do a lot of work in the infrastructure.
So how long
world.
Has that been going for?
That actual company's only been set up now since January last year. We kind of brought it in-house. I was working freelance on my own and my business partner was as well. And then we just come together and we said, let's do something. I said, well, construction support is all about construction workers who have literally put together the construction support, what is known as the foundation, and is registered as a charity now. I said, why don't we set up the company all under the same kind of umbrella? So the branding is all the same and we can show that we are on the ground of the sector as well as supporting the charitable causes as well. So yeah, we're working at a few tier one companies, Balfour Beatty. We've done a bit of work with them over the years. We're working with them on a big sea defence job out in Essex. And then we've also been working over in the other side of London doing bridge repair work, sheet piling, footpaths, curbs. Yeah, normally heavy civil stuff really is what we like. And that's kind of our forte. And we just had a couple of meetings this week about a lot of work coming up in the railway world again. So I spent 4 years working for Costains on Crossrail. Before that, I was with Volker Fitzpatrick for a year working on one of their
you've
projects.
You've seen a lot of, you've had a lot of personal experience as well.
Yeah, what I actually got to was a point where I ended up when I was about 17, 18, 19 maybe. I might have been 20 actually. I ended up going into building a landscaping and being a labourer for just a guy doing patios and driveways. And it was great, great laugh, good fun. And then a friend of mine actually said that, Steve, why don't you come work with us? We do groundworks just on a much bigger scale. You won't be pushing a wheelbarrow. We have dumper trucks for that. And we also have, you won't do any hand digging. We've got diggers for that. And I thought, no more hand digging. I was like, oh, I'm all over that. And that took me into the heavy civils world. I kind of, the mental health story side of it, all kind of, this is where it all took a turn really. But in 2009, I think it was, I had sulfuric acid thrown on me in a incident out in Essex where I live on a night out. Got caught up with the wrong people at the wrong time. Was a victim of a bottle of sulfuric acid. And that, it burned me up a little bit. It just says it was a couple of months up before or after, I think, the Katie Piper incident as well. So it's right
she's
at the same
still
time.
Out there now, isn't she, doing TV and stuff? God.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was it. She kind of... That got up. I had a few facial injuries, but fortunately got through it okay. Got the right treatment at the right time, and I was about 2 or 3 meters away from it when it happened, but it still got me quite heavily. I've overcome it quite well, but then What I didn't notice was 6 months to 8 months later, my sleeping started to really struggle. And I literally knew there was something going wrong, and I think I had a good lady next to me that she said that you need to be seen to, and going, this isn't right that you wake up at 1 o'clock in the night and then I'm awake all night, and then I get in the van at six and go to work. And I got diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, and what I kind of ignored, and I now look back, I used to always be a little bit untowards about the NHS, really. Like, they just diagnosed me, or they gave me a label and let me go. But they, when I look back at it now, it's more of a case, I was 21 years old. I didn't feel like I warranted a label like that, where I knew what PTSD was, you had to go to war to get that. That was a military thing. So I just put it off, and I ended up going, I went on a bit of a tangent, shall we say, for a good few years, and become the one who always drinks too much, or wasn't worried about getting a little bit of scrap here and there, or getting myself in a bit of trouble, and ended up suffering, really. I was kind of hurting the people around me. And then, I was diagnosed. I suffered for about a year before I got a diagnosis for it, but I suffered with ulcerative colitis of the stomach. And that was a kind of a real turning point. But once I was diagnosed with that, I was too far gone, because I'd been a bloke about it, really, and not actually said how bad the situation was. And when they said what it was, they said, we've got an emergency operation and remove my large intestine. So I had, I'm 12 foot shorter internally now. So I think it was removed of me. So I was given a bag, a pouch for literally 18 months to 2 years, I think it was.
Yeah.
Stoma bag. Yeah, had a stoma. That's the way someone actually came up yesterday on TV. I saw that saying that. Had a stoma. And then that, it was 20 months, I think, actually it was. Had that. And then, but all this time, I had two major operations and one smaller operation during that process. But every time, as soon as I was fit enough to be on my feet, I was back at work, and the construction industry just helped so much. And the company I was working for at the time, and I'll always be thankful to them, but they said, Steve, that we know you're a groundworker and you're good on the tools, but you also can talk about the job and you know what you're talking about. We know you're not fit enough to dig at the moment, but we'll put you through your supervisor tickets, and you can literally be on site and just take it as and when it comes around your kind of hospital appointments and stuff. So that was absolute blessing in disguise, the way they treated me. And that was brilliant. And then that, led on to, so by the time all this kind of the operations and all that kind of ulcerative colitis was cleared, and I had the pouch removed, the stoma removed, and I was all plumbed back in, I always say, literally. And then I went back into the construction world, and that was probably 2010, 2011, I was kind of through it all. But then I started, what I really started to notice, when I was going across all these big sites, and I'd been struggling for a number of years with, I would say really struggling, but I was just a bloke who's literally had problems in the past that literally would just show every now and then show up a little bit. But I didn't know anything about it. But I started to get really interested in why did that happen to me. I'd lost my cousin passed away in 2016 of bowel cancer, and she was 31, and in my bowel was removed. And I always remember thinking, like, it's not, they told me it wasn't hereditary, but what is it? I don't understand. And I just, again, for the power of podcasts, really, sitting in the van a lot, sort of listening to multiple podcasts. And as you all know, you can get led down a bit of a dark path sometimes listening to this stuff. But you just kind of pick and choose your directions and what you want to listen to and different guests. And then I just started to really link what trauma does to the body and how trauma plays a part in your stomach, basically, and how your stomach literally manifests stress. But any stress that you have ultimately gets manifested in the stomach. And it made so much sense to me. And there's a lot of science out there what proves it and shows it. And that's why the likes of butterflies
the
and the
incident
stomach and all this
with
kind
the,
of stuff.
The acid and the not dealing with the trauma of that, you're thinking it kind of manifested itself in these stomach issues.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a link. Like you say, it's a hard one to ever prove, but there's more science backing up that thought. And link it myself and identifying. I think especially now, and don't get me wrong, bad diet all comes into play. We worked next door. We were building a Costa Coffee, and we were working next door to McDonald's, and then we started staying up there because it was too far to travel. And when we was working, it was in Farnborough over that way. And I lived the other side. It was 2 hours there, 2 hours home. And the whole life and the being beasted by the industry, really, the diet and everything, slash, I was a complete cocktail, shall we say, of just problems, I think, and the way I was dealing with my own body.
Well, it's like you say, it's like a lifestyle, isn't it? Because you're away from home, you're eating crap, you're drinking too much, you're not getting enough rest. You know, it's going to show itself,
isn't
it?
I had all this. Yeah, so I had all this going on anyway, so that was bad enough. But then at the same time, I never slept properly at night either because everything else, so chuck that into the equation with it. And I spoke to the surgeon, the doctor, and I spoke to therapists in the past, and they pretty much said that you were physically able to deal with it, mentally able to deal with it in terms of you just crack on because this is all you know. They said, but your body can't keep up with that, and something had to give. And then it starts to show physically, and you see that now with so many people, don't you, when people... And I get it as well. My wife will spot with me when I'm run down and that. She'll say, you look knackered. Like when you're mentally drained, your body starts to show it, even just visually, really. And yeah, I just massively got into that. And then I got onto a few big sites. I was working on a big Thames Water job, AMK Deepums, it was called, a huge sewage treatment plant. Best civil job I've ever been on. The worst smelling job I've ever been on, that's for sure. It was a sewage farm. But it was such a good job. But then... I was fascinated by the mental health stuff, and we got a mental health first aider on site to come and do the course for a few people, and I just massively disagreed with it, and I didn't, and there was so much I just said.
Go on, I want to hear this then. So mental health first aid is kind of one of those, it's a somewhat new thing, and it's the kind of, not necessarily, it's not about counselling, is it? It's about sort of pinpointing and listening to people, as far as I'm aware. So what didn't you agree with about that?
Well, in the long term, what I've kind of got to realise now is that it should just be called the mental health awareness course and not a mental health first aid course. We've had stories of people dealing with people on site and literally calling them their patients or their kind of like, as if they're, and like, you're just, and these people do 2-day course and think that they are then a trained psychiatrist. And because the way the course is, it's like you will be able to deal with people as a first aider to support people with mental health issues. And I'm like, you definitely don't. You're definitely not. But we had a lot. I booked the course in. I got the job to actually do the course, to bring an instructor in for us to all to do. So I was really championing it. And it was only at halfway through the course. I thought, in my head, I was like, this sounds dangerous to me. And I had a lot of questions throughout, as I normally do, and they just couldn't answer it. And it was along the lines of that somebody's suicidal now. What do I do? And they were like, the ultimate answer was ring 999. And I was like, that doesn't really feel like this should be the answer on a course like this. It feels... like, if that's the answer, then why have you made a course about helping these people if the answer to anything with these deep problems is just to ring 999? And I come out of it with more questions than I did answers and understanding, really. We've been contacted as a charity now as well. I would say in the hundreds of people trying to sell us, can we come to you to sell courses to your network? Right. And I say no to all of them. Well, we're not. We dealt with one company before that were very good, Elite Force Safety. I'll give them a little plug, but they're from the military kind of background as well. And they were very, very good, and they'd done it differently. And I liked that a lot. But all the other ones who were doing it under the Mental Health First Aid England stuff, it was. I honestly think it's put more people in danger than secured people.
And let me ask this then. So if you're saying that you don't think the Mental Health First Aid course is beneficial, what would be beneficial then, in your opinion? Because obviously there's a problem. So what sort of training should companies or what support should companies be doing, you know, if they don't do that?
I think... it even comes to a point of it shouldn't even be training. It should just, but maybe I've been brought up differently in a positive way, but just good morals and an understanding of a good lifestyle.
Really hard to treat people. You know, I mean, how do you know if someone's got good morals, you know?
And you can't, and it's so hard to do. Yeah,
somebody splashed acid kind of in your face. I mean, that you would never imagine that would have happened. That's a hard one, isn't it?
Yeah. And this is what I'd say about it. It's kind of in the construction sector alone. It's like, look at the way that we're treating people. Like, look at the way that people work. Like, take a step back. I always say to people, it's hard to read the label from inside the jar. I think I heard before what I loved. And it was like, if you look at the way this industry is dealing with people, companies aren't being paid on time. That rolls down the chain completely. and companies haven't got the time or the funding in place because they're chasing money too much to even support their staff. And the way that we have seen and what it has done is it's become the mental health first aid stuff. And a lot of courses has become a massive tick box exercise. I speak to people now, I'll go on any building site and just say to them, oh, do you know who your first aid, mental health first aider is? And they'll say, yeah, it's someone in the office at
right,
HQ.
Okay,
there's no one on the ground who's really trained to deal with that stuff or even trained mental health first aid England-wide. The message from that hasn't gone downhill and onto site. And my fear, if you look at when that come in, what was that probably? It was an Australian idea, wasn't it? I think they'd done it in Australia, then they brought it over here. But these statistics have just got worse and worse year on year. Now, there's got to be, and I honestly think it is, when you look at the problems in this sector, I'm sure we'll speak about the Riddle stuff soon, but when you look at the actual bigger picture of construction, you know you're not going to fix this with a two-day course.
I think the mental health, I mean, I've never been on the course, so I can't really, and I don't, it's not a course that I teach, so I don't actually know enough about it, really. I mean, I know that it's supposed to be that it's providing people within the organisation to be able to signpost, you know, those who are struggling to other offshoot support systems. And I think because of, you know, the NHS being on its knees, I guess the employer doing their bit is going to be, you know, well, A, it's the moral thing to do, isn't it, as an employer? I think it should also be the legal thing to do as well. But also it's supporting the UK economy as well, because obviously the NHS, as I say, can't afford to, for every single one of us who's struggling with mental health, to support us with medicines or you know, counselling or whatever. But I just wonder then, I mean, my big problem, Steve, with the mental health stuff at work is when we do health and safety, and you'll know this from, you know, if you've got a trip hazard on the site, remove the trip hazard, and so no one can fall over it. But with stress, we wait for somebody, or mental health, we wait for somebody to be struggling and then support them.
Yeah.
But that's reactive. Yeah, sure. Surely every other part of safety is about prevention as opposed to cure. Whereas with stress, we look at it as cure. How can we cure the person as opposed to how can we prevent them being stressed in the first place? And that, I mean, I don't know the answer to it. I don't know the one size fits all, do this and everyone will be fine. But I certainly think that, like some of the things you mentioned before about paying people on time and expecting them to have a life outside of work and supporting them, you know, in, you know, having realistic, I don't know, realistic working hours and that sort of thing. I mean, you see these, I drive up and down the country a lot with my work, and I obviously see lots of people in white vans driving up and down the country as well, probably to and from building sites, and they're always asleep. So I'm thinking to myself,
definitely,
they're either up so ridiculously early or they've worked so blooming hard that they're exhausted all the time. And I presume that's what it's like 100%. In real life.
It is, and when you look at the we'd be better off educating people about diet and nutrition, because you see, I've seen it this morning. I'd a builder turn up, literally can of Red Bull in one hand and a pack of crisps in the other, and this is at 7 o'clock this morning. And when you actually think, when you start to learn and understand what sugar does to the human body and stuff like that, and just the salt level, all this kind of stuff. I'm no nutritionist, and I've got no perfect diet by any stretch of the imagination.
No, I saw you having your chocolate milkshake for breakfast this morning.
I did have a chocky milk, my little sugar kick. And the it's just there's so much wrong, I think. And like, one thing I always say, like, if a company, can't say it, literally one of these tier one contractors, the size they are, why haven't they employed a full-time psychiatrist to study their workplace? Like, they employ a million other things. They pay God knows how many people to deal with social value and tree planting in the company. Why don't they look at someone who can actually study the workforce, who's going to easily justify their money, who's going to probably improve the work thing? But why wouldn't you employ? So all they're doing now is you train up a few members of staff to be mental health first aiders, and a lot of time these people are middle management, and they haven't got time for this stuff. We know that now, and the world now, we're all under so much pressure. The last thing they want to be doing is for you to open up about their feelings. And I had one, my little boy had been born nearly 6 years ago now, scarily. And I got contacted by someone, and they said, it was I was on paternity, technically, paternity. I was off for a week or two without being paid because I was self-employed. And then I got a phone call from someone saying, "Hi, I've been passed your number. I'm in a really bad way." And this person was in a literally suicidal position and said, "I've been passed your number." And I've had this twice, actually. And I ended up going a bit mad at him, really. And I turned around and said, "Who do you think you are?" It was a little less PC. But I said, "Who do you think you are coming to me to tell me about your problems? I'm here with my little boy at home. I haven't got a clue how to keep him alive, let alone you as well." And I just kind of put it to him very, very raw. And I said, "Where did you get my number from?" And he said, "Someone on the building site that you work at has given it to me." And I was like, "Okay." I said, "Where do you work?" And he wasn't even in the construction world. He just literally, someone had seen my name up on the wall and literally given my details to this person. And I was like, "That's not what that's about. Someone's seen my picture and my number. Someone's worried about thinking one of their friends is going to kill himself. Just pass them Steve's number, they'll be fine." And I ended up having to deal with that. And that was from that day. That was when I really started to see. I thought, this is dangerous, this, because people are ringing people up thinking they can save lives when they really aren't dealt with it. But then what you also think is, I've then gone to bed that night thinking, is that guy going to kill himself? And if he wakes up in the morning, if whoever finds that guy in the morning or whenever, they're going to look at his phone, and the last person he's phoned is me. And I was completely selfish of me, but I was like, I'm going to look like I've talked him into killing himself or something. And that was kind of just like a real honest, what kind of, yeah, my view on it. And I was just like, that can't be the way. But then I went to, and it's kind of going off the tangent a little bit, but I went to St. James's Gardens, I think it's called, what was a burial ground behind Station, HS2. I went there one day to have a look at it because they removed thousands of bodies. It was an old burial ground. And I went in there, and that was the first time I saw it. They had full-time care assistants on the job, professional care. I don't think they were psychiatrists, but they were trained people to deal with and help people, therapists in a way of some description. And they were on site. And I said to them, "How come you're here?" And they said, they've got people. So when you looked in this massive marquee, if you go on Google Images and look it up, you'll see a lot of stuff where it looked like it was like the marquee was about the same size as one or two football pitches, all being dug up. But they needed so many architects. Archaeologists. They needed so many archaeologists on that project that they had to bring people in from overseas. And a lot of these people, it was their first job as well, where they'd come straight out of university. So these people weren't really had to deal with a job of this scale before ever. And a lot of the people who were trained in there hadn't dealt with anything on that scale. And then they had funeral directors there for everybody that was dug up and moved. It had to be done in a patriotic way, or however you call it. And that had to be done properly. So a lot of this whole marquee of what looked like construction workers in their oranges actually wasn't. They were actually all just different professions that dealt with archaeological digs and stuff. But they had all trained professionals in there. And I always kind of and ah to myself, like, they would never have that. And if that tent was full of just construction workers, that they wouldn't have had that support staff there. And that's me being a little bit always thinking that we're looked down on, I suppose. But I'm like, there's a real kind of the folk on the ground of the industry really aren't that well respected in a way that even through COVID.
But do you think it's also because there's this image that like construction workers are like blokey blokes and they can do anything and, you know, they're not going to get upset by a few dead bodies? I mean, do you think that's that type of image?
I honestly just think it's those people. If you're in construction, you're on the ground, you are the dirt of the world. You're the dirt of society. I honestly think that. And I'm talking that from my own personal experiences of being a construction worker. I was only there was a lot come out in the press, and we spoke to a few people last week about the abuse that you find working on the roads and road workers. And you look at the way that people, I was called the W word, should I say, to put it like this time in the morning. Three times last week working on a bridge, putting some curbs in, me and the team. Three times I heard it in 2 days. Just someone drove past and just hurtled abuse. And then for no reason, but it's very much the point of if I wasn't in my oranges and I was just in my jeans and a jumper, you would never say that to me. If I was out of this uniform, that is just not. And guess what? And you see it. I think you've seen it in the park. There's people picking fights with these. And then a lot of big, scary people would come up and go up for these construction workers. And you think you would never do that in a pub or out in a normal environment, social environment. Why does it feel like, because this person, if it's like you're in your uniform, that means you're not allowed to actually do anything to me. So that person's got the upper hand on you. I don't know. It's very,
a funny way of looking at it. I don't know if you've seen the HSE statistics that came out, like, so effectively last year's, because obviously we haven't got this year's yet, but the acts of violence are now in the top five causes of workplace injuries. 8% of all work-related injuries are due to acts of violence, which is absolutely flabbergasting. I mean, recently the co-op did some sort of survey of their workers, and something like 47% of co-op supermarket staff have been physically, verbally, or sexually assaulted. I mean, they're supermarket workers.
It's bonkers, isn't it? Absolutely bonkers.
It's just.
But the people, and the people with it as well. And I even think it from the people on the ground as well. These people, like construction workers that I know, everyone's mortgages are going up at the moment. All money, everything in society is going up and up and up. So everyone's under so much more pressure that, guess what? Pressure is a cooker, isn't it, really? As soon as you too much pressure in there, it's going to go pop. And every bill that goes up, it's more pressure on the person.
It makes it reminds me, Steve, of that digger driver in Liverpool in, was it 2019?
Yeah, 100%.
Drove through the, was it a travel lodge or a Premier Inn or something?
Was it it's travel or something. Yeah, one of those, wasn't it?
And he was just so absolutely frustrated. And he literally, because he was owed loads of money, and he just literally drove through because he was just furious.
But look at the comments. The comments would all be directed at the kind of how wrong that man is for doing that. I'm like, that is what happens when someone is pushed beyond the means. Okay, and some people take more pushing than others, don't get me wrong, but if you're going to do that to a person who's got to provide, who's got bills and all got all this underneath him, then guess what? He's going to do so. I went into a prison a few years back just to visit and spoke to some people in there. And they literally ended up in there just off because one day they just flipped their lid and done something wrong. And one act of violence, what they was completely out of character, has put them inside for a number of years. And that is what stress does to people. And I really don't think this industry sees it. And like we've got major contract, like I say, and Galliford Try literally saying a few months back, I was looking at stuff online and they were saying about, I don't know, you go on to look at their press online about how they support this, they've won this job, they've won that, everything's great. And then I get a phone call from three different people I know on the same job, and they've been promised a summer's worth of work and they're happy as Larry. And then suddenly they just get laid off on the Thursday because they want to stop works for a few months. Now those people, their bills have all gone up, but the company at the top all want to preach what we're doing for the industry, what we're doing for these people. But that's another way we look at it now. Should there be, where like, especially this tier one, the major contracting route, a lot of the guys on the ground there actually aren't self-employed workers. They all go for umbrella companies. So they are within right, supposed to be dealt with at like an employee. However, they get laid off on a Friday and told they ain't got a job on a Monday. And I think, again, it's because these companies don't think that the people are educated enough to realise, but those people should be given at least a 1 or 2 weeks' notice.
Well, that loyalty goes two ways, though, doesn't it? Because as much as you can lay off
your
group on Monday, they can just walk out on Monday as well and go, do you know what, we're not working anymore for you. And then they'll be stuck, wouldn't they?
Yeah, but I do think there should be something contractually. And that's exactly, it definitely works both ways. But okay, well, if you walk out this week without giving us notice period, you're going to lose your wage this week, because that effective comes out of what would be your notice period. That person wouldn't then work off.
Yeah.
So if everyone was just kind of was told to deal with it, and there is so much, and especially we don't actually get contacted by the major. I know them all, so I've worked for them, and I know them all very well. I know the bosses and everyone of these major kind of labour suppliers. They don't want to get involved with what I'm doing because they know I know too much about the way they operate. And they keep themselves to themselves. They get themselves tied into a framework on a project, and they just like to do, these companies will do just about enough to keep the client happy. And they won't go out of their way anymore to push or show themselves in any way unless they really have to.
Just sort of upset the apple cart in any way.
100%. And it's exactly that. I could literally name you four companies if I felt like it right now, just so I know firsthand. But
you can tell me once you stop recording.
But it's essentially that, isn't it? Yeah, what are they doing? And once a year going to planting some trees once a year, or taking, I don't know, donating 20 quid to the local children's hospice one day a year. Is that really enough?
No, but it makes good social media, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? It's so painful to see. It's like, we speak to companies, and I thought, I got another meeting this afternoon, actually, unfortunately. And fair play, they've come back to me and said, Steve, we want to get something in place last year. And we didn't. I apologise, but at the same time, someone's just took their own life on site 2 weeks ago, and we realise now that we can't just be touching this subject with you and not actually doing something. So I was like, well, there you go. Well, we get it all the time. The as you mentioned earlier, that it's the reactive way of doing it.
And I think that's the thing, a lot, isn't it? Is that as human beings, we're pretty reactive, aren't we? So it's not unsurprising that businesses do the same. They might talk as if they're going to be proactive, but I think it's often, as you mentioned before, it's just that knee-jerk response, isn't it?
Yeah, and I spoke to someone the other day, actually, who was, I can't remember where they was from or who it was, but they were there from overseas, and they said that they see especially a British thing as well, to be reactive, and that's always the way it's going.
Okay.
And even to the point, I had a meeting yesterday with a rail company, it went really well, and it's good, and the railway world's looking promising for the next 5 years because budgets have come in, and that's looking good. But this morning, it was like Network Rail wanted praise for literally repairing this landslide. I can't remember where it was, somewhere in the southeast, because it's a local news station. They were literally like, yeah, they've done this, they've put these amount of sheet piles in because of this landslide, they've done this, they've done that. Like, how successful it's been is great, and huge credit to Network Rail and its supply chain. I'm like, well, not really, because you haven't maintained it. And you're just waiting for this stuff to go wrong. Yeah, fair, like, well done, you've repaired it. But actually, when you look at the bigger picture, a train could have gone past at that same time. Yeah. It could have killed
fast. I just put this fire out. By the way, I started it as well.
it's literally that, isn't it? You see it all the time. Yeah, so much. It's just like, yeah, look, we've just done this. It was one the other day, classic version of that. And it was like, the problem wouldn't be there if you'd nipped it in the bud at the start. So don't try and take credit for it. I'll tell you what it was. We went out with a fair play, and they've kind of admitted it as well. I think National Highways, I get on really well with them. They've been brilliant. But we went out collecting all the plastic sleeves that the trees get planted into.
Yeah.
Obviously grow at the start. And they did say like, we need to look at this actually being not a day out to do it, but a company needs to go out to tender for someone to go and replace these, because these things were put in 20 years ago. And they were supposed to be taken out within the first 4 or 5 years, and it's now 20 years later. And I said, well, we can't really take any credit for it then, can we? Because you've put the problem there in the start, and now you've just picked up your mess, and now you're trying to get a bit of press saying how well we're doing. So, that is hypocrisy,
shall we say. Although we put it there in the first place.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's bonkers. But
I want to talk now about construction sport then. So you set up this, it's not a charity, is it a charity?
We are a charity, yes. So technically, well, the charity commission knows us, the Construction Sport Foundation.
Okay, so if anybody wants to donate, can they donate sport? if they want to? Do you take donations?
Yeah, you sure can.
So have you got a website? Donations,
it will help. Yeah, there's a website, constructionsport.com.
The reason I stumbled across Steve, because you've got a YouTube channel, haven't you, which is very successful. Sport team. Yeah, it's good. Steve is very good at talking, because on his videos, you're pretty much just talking to yourself the whole time, aren't you?
Yeah, the TikTok world. Yeah, it is actually. Yeah, I do put it on there as well. Yeah, it's actually. We're pretty much waiting for some more funding to come in so we can speak to people. But in the meantime, I'm just talking to myself.
You know what they say about that, don't you? That's most likely to get sense if you talk to yourself, aren't you? So,
I still internally.
So Construction Sport is about, if I'm kind of summarizing this is about looking at exercise and sport, but sort of connected with work, but outside of the work environment. Is that right?
Yes, bang on. The way we kind of nip it in a quick line is providing sporting opportunities for the construction workforce to enjoy themselves.
Okay.
Give people a break and a bit of fresh air and understanding of the benefits of just having a bit of downtime is what we like to create. And we know that is only done by people creating the opportunity to do it, really. And that is as simple as
any companies that are literally on board with this? This is something they do all the time. This is something that they've run with this idea. Have you got sort of, companies that are pledging to do this?
A little plug. Yeah, we just started off our own. It's called the 100 Club. It's literally a membership, just as low cost, £100 a month for a company to be part of it. And it's just a community of companies now coming together to promote the benefits of sport and exercise along with ourselves. And that we've done it quite clearly, actually, because there's a number of charities in the sector that we realized do massive, massive fundraising events, but you never actually see a penny of the money, and it never kind of adds up to where that money's come and where it's gone. And as I say, mental health and construction is very much still rocketing in terms of going up in terms of negativity. So we were literally set up and we said that £100 a month will go towards us from each company, goes towards the staff and the costs of running the kind of the charity itself and put events together. And then what we get to do then is when we run our own events and fundraise at our own events, the fundraising we get, 100% of the money fundraised on that day can then be donated to a beneficiary. And that could be from the likes of people, I know someone who's just, so people have fallen on hard times basically. So yeah, we've done it. Well, just actually, we've done a golf day when I was on Crossrail 5-6 years ago now. And that had a, yeah, we've done it for a colleague that didn't take long, but he passed away, unfortunately, of a brain tumor, but he had a wife and two children. He'd just recently left being employed and got into the self in freelance world. So his bills wasn't covered. And then I put together a golf day. I'd never done one before and I quite enjoyed it. Didn't know what I was doing. And we had a great day out and we raised some decent funding for his family. And then from that day, it was a bit, I kept being asked, can I put an event together? And I'm no events organizer at all, but I'm not really scared of failure, put it that way. It's one of those, we don't fail, we learn sort of jobs really. And it's from that day, I've just realized how good the construction community is at supporting each other. And when push comes to shove, I think we're quite a close-knit bunch. And you realize when someone's not well or suffering or someone passes away, it puts you in a position of that could have been me. If that was me, what would I want for my family, or what would I want people to do for my family?
Yeah, it's interesting. You say that, because you know I mentioned just before about the digger driver that drove into the hotel in Liverpool.
Yeah.
Literally immediately afterwards, somebody created a Just Fund Me or GoFundMe or whatever and raised 2,700 quid. So the guy didn't go without food and rent and whatever.
Yeah.
So people rallying around to go, no, it's not right that you haven't got paid, mate. Here's some money, which I think, yeah. But can I ask you a question then? So imagine one of the listeners has a company and they want to get involved in this 100 Club. What are the benefits? So what do they get for their 100 quid effectively?
So we're now sharing information around the topics that we do, toolbox talks and things like that. We pretty much are doing them as well online now and sending them out to all our members so they can use them. They can be sent through to their company as well via links on their phone and WhatsApp. So it's not all just all kind of paper-based. We're trying to make that a little bit different. And then we're creating opportunities every 8 weeks. We put together, we've just started it a few weeks ago, one in the city, Sir Robert McAlpine, gladly let us use their facilities. And we had a bit of like a small networking breakfast for everyone to come together and start talking about this and what's going on. And it given us an opportunity to kind of listen to what companies want and need. And we are, with their evidence and hearing back from people, it's a case of that this is what we need to challenge and this is what we need to do. So it's the way of doing it, we say it's a £100 pledge to the charity, so charity kind of donation. And in the back, we want people just to be seen. We've got a kind of a certificate-based kind of accreditation route that we're looking at now as well. So companies can be not only recognised for supporting us, but when it comes to tender stages and things like that, to show what they're doing for the workforce, they can quite clearly show they're supporting them by being involved with us. So we've got a football match next Wednesday coming up, and all the companies that support us are all invited to that. And that's literally for a small, I think we ask people to buy a raffle ticket on the night. There's no big fees, there's no charges or sponsorship costs. It's a case of saying, we've got this event for our members. Are you about, can you be involved? So that is the rugby one. We've got another walk. We're doing a marathon walk for our members in London on the 15th of May, I believe it is. Wednesday the 15th of May. And that, again, is just a case of us getting our members involved in sport and exercise. But we're very kind of stringent on, we don't just want the director to turn up for a networking, do we want some of your workforce as well? Okay. So that's been really good. And we're getting a mixed bunch from each company to come and get involved. And it's something completely different. It's never been done before. And it's very much we're learning on the job.
Is it just in the southeast at the moment that you're kind of focusing?
No, we actually want to be national. To be honest, we want to go around the world with it. It'd be fantastic. But We are working with a guy called Fred Mills, who runs B1M. I'm not sure if you've seen him, but he's got a campaign called Get Construction Talking. And he's put it out to the world, really, and said that there's a massive... He's a YouTuber with over 3 million subscribers, and he's an ex-construction site manager slash engineer. And he's literally started off this YouTube channel, what's gone mad busy with it. And yeah, he's got a huge team now, and they've got behind us and four other charities and are helping support us and putting our name out across the world, what's really interesting. But I've got a meeting, a phone call to make this afternoon, actually, with someone who's going to head up our northern division, hopefully.
Brilliant.
That's quite cool, or just a northern kind of area. Yeah, we really want to have representatives all over. As I mentioned earlier, we're looking at ways that we can do construction rugby, so you can represent English construction and play against the home nations of Wales, Scotland and Ireland. And the thing with that, we've done it with a football as well before, but the rugby one was quite interesting. But we say it's sport and exercise, but we hired Saracens Rugby Club a few years ago and we've done Leicester Tigers last year. But it was a good day out for the construction workers, for the guys to go out, have a great game of rugby and enjoy an evening after. But what I always said to people was like, that just looks like a bunch of blokes going out for a game of rugby and too many beers, really. And I'm like, that is therapy for every single one of those people there. And I know it's not what the wives wouldn't understand it, I'm sure. But I'm like, for us, it's in years to come. And I've been there. I played at Worcester Stadium quite a few years, about 15 years ago now. But if you've had a bad week in the rugby and you play rugby, if you had a bad week and then suddenly you switch on the TV on the weekend, and I'd had this on a Friday night at a crap week and then switched on the TV and then suddenly Saracens were playing Worcester, and it's actually at Worcester Stadium. And I remember sitting there and literally it gave me a little bit of happiness inside. I went, oh, I've played at that stadium. And then you remember the day that you were at that stadium, yeah, and the good experience that you had. So you've gone from being negative and sitting down with the ump, and suddenly you have this little glimmer of hope. And I said that to the guys that we played at Saracens and at Leicester. And then when we said that, I was like, just remember when you switch the TV on when you're having a down day and you see Saracens Rugby Club pop up, just remember the day that we had there.
You're on that pitch.
It gives you a reason. Yeah, you're on that pitch enjoying yourself. And there's the good times are out there and they will come again.
I've got to ask this question. I presume that you are open to the ladies of construction as well.
Yeah, 100%. Too right. Yeah, so we're playing some football as well. The walks have been brilliant, actually, with the women. But we've actually had a couple of girls come involved saying, can we look at a netball tournament in London this summer as well? So, yeah, 100%. Yeah, we're open. We're open to absolutely everything, everyone, everything. There's no discrimination, anything. And it's one of those we've got two guys behind the media side of it and myself, and a number of volunteers that help when it comes to it. But, yeah, we can only do so much. So when people say, what are we doing as well for the ladies, like, well, what do you want to do? Let's do it. Yeah. We're a blank canvas for everything. We're actually talking about paddle boarding down on the local rivers this summer as well. So we actually want to be part of it, any sport and every sport in any way, whether that's just getting people out doing something. I think that's in this industry, you don't get much of a break.
No.
And that's what we need to realize, that we do need
so
that.
The reason I stumbled across you like originally was as I say, I saw that you had put some, I think it was a video on your YouTube channel and stuff about making suicide riddle reportable. Now, we've just done a series on the channel, so for the listeners who don't know what riddle is, just go back a few episodes and you can see all the information about the riddle regulations. But tell me about this kind of campaign, as it were, of yours to make suicide riddle reportable. Yeah. Where's this come from?
I literally, as many things in my life, just stumbled across it, really. And the idea come to me typically 4 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning, the one day you get a lay in and suddenly you have this light bulb moment and it's the most inconvenient time ever. but I wrote to the HSE a year or two ago now, maybe a couple of years ago, and explained to them what I do, who I am and what I'm looking to do. But I wanted a bit of an understanding on how they deal with mental health in construction as such. And as you guys will very much know in your background, just kind of the rules and regs and the laws and all this kind of stuff. Because everyone always kept telling me the HSE can't do anything because they haven't got the funding. And then if you need the HSE to change, you need to speak to government to change that and all this technical jargon. And And I wrote an email to them, but at the bottom of the email, they just literally wrote, oh, Mr. Kurzak, with regards to the Riddle situation, as you can see on our website, and it is there available on the website, suicide is not dealt with as a riddle. It is the detail or the situation with a suicide on site or off site is passed on to a coroner. Mm-hmm. And then the coroner will, if there's speculation there about, so if there's questions around how it's happened, it can go back to the HSC or whatever. But it was very unclear, and it just pretty much said it was a complete slippery shoulders from the HSC, really, saying it's not there for us to deal with. So I then woke up in the morning, literally I read that, and in the morning woke up and I thought, no, that's not right. And I just started looking into it more and more. But my head with it as well was I was contacted by the HSC 2 years ago with regards to some video content that we'd made. And they said to me, Steve, can we use, I'll say his name. His name was Mr. Grant. His name was Paul Ashby, I think it was. He used to work there. I've called him out because he never got back to me. So if I say it now, he might come back to me. But he said to me, literally, we would like to use your content for a campaign that we've got going forward called the... what's that one they've only just put out the last few months? Get the something like, oh, I can't remember what it is now. I've paid less, not enough attention to it, but they've got a campaign that's out at the moment.
The manual handling the construction they had. Give me that one.
Yeah, there's one. No, there's one now. It's more driven down the route of stress in the workplace, really. And they want to use my video footage. So I said, yeah, no worries. I said, use whatever you'd like. I said, it's all there. I said, I'll get the people who are in the videos talking. I know the ones you're talking about. They'd be more than happy. I know these people firsthand. We'd be more than willing to help. And I never heard anything back from them again. And I thought, oh, that's not really on. They've just completely used me for an hour of conversation and not even replying to me now. And I just kind of thought, no, this isn't right. And then I looked at it and I thought, hang on a sec. If they don't deal with... From my understanding of a risk assessment, a method statement, a RAMS, and all that kind of stuff, if they don't deal with suicide, then how do I do a RAMS based on stress? So stress in the workplace. And I've always looked at it as in, if I'm working with a circular saw, what's the worst thing that could happen? I could cut my arm off, hit a vein, and die on site, I believe. I've got to state the worst case scenarios and the danger levels to that and the outcome and the systems in place to deal with that. Mental health stress in the workplace obviously has huge implications in terms of stress, just anything, breakdowns or obviously the worst case scenario of stress in the workplace is suicide, isn't it? Ultimately, that's kind of big black and white of it. So what do I do if someone takes their own life in the workplace? And from my point of view perspective, the HSC were just saying, oh, you just go to the coroner. But I'm like, well, I just don't see how that's not a HSC thing to deal with. I got a bit uptight about it and was like, there must be something with this. And then I know firsthand of three construction workers in the last 12 months or 18 months now who have taken their own lives on a building site in central London. There's three different cases. It's happened on a building site. Actually, and if you take Essex into it, I know four, actually. And the thought that is then put down as a personal issue, the person who took, and it was, that's what they said, this email back to me, it's a personal situation. So I was like, well, I've got guys that work for me. I could say to them, look, you want your job next week. I need you to go to drive around the country day in, day out, and then I'm going to beast you, and then I'm going to deny you paying you overtime, and then I'm going to pay you late, and I'm just going to do everything in my head that's literally going to go against you mentally. But then, as an employer, and don't get me wrong, this does happen. You know, we all know there's bad employers out there. Someone then goes and takes their own life because of the way they've been dealt with, and the coroner would, or it gets passed to the coroner as a personal issue. This person must have a bad past, or I don't know, was into something or struggling somewhere else. It's not a workplace situation.
Yeah, but right.
Sorry, my head goes a million miles an hour. I'm trying to be clear. So I'm just like, this is a workplace situation, isn't
right.
it?
Right.
So how can that not be dealt with?
I know it's not construction, but I'm sure you would have been living under a rock if you weren't aware of Ruth Perry, the head teacher, in January last year.
This is, This is exactly where this
In the Prevention of Future Deaths report, they clearly identified across everybody they'd spoke to, doctors, work colleagues, family members, friends, that there was no history of mental health as far as Ruth was concerned.
Yeah.
That it went from she was perfectly happy, very diligent head teacher at that primary school, to Ofsted reports comes in, 2 days later she hangs herself, you know?
Yeah.
And that wasn't the first head teacher as well. I mean, this is, you know, I know we're talking about construction here because obviously in construction it's so much more prevalent, the work-connected suicides. But I completely agree. I mean, I don't understand how they, I mean, I read a report recently by the TUC, the uni and the TUC, and they were absolutely screaming for the HSE to be investigating work-related suicides, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? And that's what when I started looking into it more, got Google up and started seeing what was going on, I was like, ah, hang on a second, I'm not the only one who's thinking this. Why is it like this? So I then started studying. There's a lady you might have come across called Professor Sarah Walters. She's fascinating. And she studies French employment, but she was brought into the inquiry, I believe, or she was definitely tweeting about it. She was part of it with that roof, with the Ofsted report. She was brought into it about why the RIDOR system should incorporate suicide. And I just, in heart of hearts, and I went out there and I put it up, you could go back on my LinkedIn a year ago, and the first time I put it up, I got a bit of a backlash from people and negativity towards the idea, this stupid idea, this groundworker just thinks this is a... this idea would work, that would never work because of this, that would never work for that. I put it down in the next, well, I don't know how long, I don't know much about all the world of the health and safety law and laws in general, but I think, and we will keep banging the drum, we will make it part of it. I honestly think they will have to give in, and I will, I don't really care. I'll expose as much evidence as I need to do it to make sure that they do something about it, because the stuff that is going on is raw, wrong, and criminal, to be honest, absolute criminal, I think. That the way that these people can be dealt with, whether it's construction or not. But the whole RIDOR system, I honestly think it's just wrong to palm it off and say it's not.
No, I mean, they even have on the HSE website, they even have a whole section on suicide prevention. So they clearly see that there is this, you know, that mental health issues. So it, last year, statistically then, so as far as the HSE are concerned, 875,000 work-related stress, depression, anxiety, PTSD cases or whatever. And as you say, if you were risk assessing that, which you're supposed to do, because even though there isn't a stress at work law, that general manage people's health, you know, all encompassing, if you're doing a risk assessment and you're thinking, how might people be harmed? Then yes, of course, there is a potential that somebody could take their lives. I mean, sadly now, those listening will be aware of somebody who has taken their own life. I mean, I was only talking to my sisters last night about a friend of my brother-in-law's, and he's had numerous people he knows that have taken their own lives. You know, it's like, oh, another month, another life, another funeral, you know. This is becoming more and more the kind of go-to way that some people are choosing to deal with this. So clearly... this is hugely significant. And if these problems are being created by being at work, so looking at Ruth Perry, had she not been a head teacher at that school, I'm going to put my neck on the line and say she would not have taken her own life. So the reason she took her life was connected to work. And if something happens that causes somebody to die as a result of the work that they do, it should be investigated. Doesn't matter how they died, it should be investigated by the HSE.
Yep, definitely. And the stuff that I've seen as well, like even the RIDOR stuff, and I think you guys did great on your previous podcast of breaking it down and taking it to its simplest form, really, isn't it? Showing what it's about. And I've been asked to literally cover stuff up in the past. I've been asked to get people onto a job before the RIDOR thing kicks in within 2 or 3 days, just to get someone to sign in and send them home again and just say, just to show that they were there. And that was actually courtesy of Buckingham's, actually. I can say that now because they've gone bust as well. So that just shows where that kind of went for them. But it was like, in a way, I just thought, if we're going to be serious about understanding mental health and well-being in the work site, in the work environment, and then we've got to take this seriously. We've got to investigate it in the right ways. And there was an article put out by a guy called Mark Anthony in the Demolition World, and it was brilliant. And this isn't his idea. I think it was brought up a little while back. A lot of people may have heard it. But during the Second World War, they studied aeroplanes and how to make certain aeroplanes stronger for fighting overseas. And they started at first looking at the holes that were in the planes that were returning.
Oh, yeah.
And what they didn't look at, they started engineering planes based on how can we make less holes in this aeroplane, because this one's, the wings have got holes in, this part's got holes in. But then what they actually realized was completely wrong was these planes all made it back with those holes in the side. So they can withstand that. The ones that they need to be investigating and find out where they can't get hit are the ones that have come down in the water. And that's a very tough world. And I kind of turned that into a mental health and construction kind of scenario, and was like, we can't learn what's killing people in our sector by speaking to the people that have survived. We need to look at the stories of the people who aren't here. And I get it. That's a very private, in a way, and a tough, tough situation. But I'm not saying we've got to delve into the lives of these people outside of the industry, but we can learn. There's got to be ways, especially in the lines of law and how people are questioned at the time of death or something, is there must be a section of questioning that can go into what was the circumstances of this person, where was this person working, and what was the environment that this person was working in, because we spend a lot more time at work than we do with our own people, with our loved ones.
Yeah.
So our work life is always going to play a huge part on our actual all-round life.
Yeah.
So how can we not study that? You know what I mean?
So, I remember...
It's asbestos and all that stuff, isn't it? They said you'll never be able to look into that, but look at it now.
Exactly.
But, and the thing with it, sorry to butt in, but is the only... And as shocking as it is, the only reason why regulations that have changed in the last few years in construction is because of Grenfell. And that is, if you look at all the regulations, they always touch on something to do with fire standards and that, because there was so much pressure put on them because of Grenfell, and rightly so. But that same pressure, I believe, needs to be applied based on suicide.
I completely agree. Well, I remember, so just go back a few years, COVID, yeah? And you know when they made COVIDs reportable, and if you had cases of COVID in the workplace and stuff, and everybody was like, but how do you know where the COVID's come from? And the rhetoric they applied, the HSE said to apply to it, was the most likely point of transmission or contraction. Okay, the place that it was most likely to have been given to you. And obviously with COVID, for most of us, those of us who were working, it was work, because when we came home, maybe everyone at home was actually staying in, they weren't going anywhere, we hadn't been anywhere, we hadn't been to the gym or anywhere because everywhere was closed. And so the most likely point of contraction or transmission was probably work. Can't we look at suicide in the same and go, well, actually, this person's got no relationship problems, you know, money was a bit of a worry, but actually the stress from work, the excessive drinking was because of work, the drug use was because of work, the self-harming was because of, you know, can't we look at it like that? Like, look at the most likely point, the trigger point. I mean, that's what my thoughts are. Just talking to you now, I'm thinking, well, that sort of, we can't just absolutely go, well, it's probably multiple issues. Why? Yes, of course, it's probably multiple issues. But in the case of that, of Ruth, the investigation, the report into her death said, no, it was the Ofsted inspection. So how do we then wrap that up?
The evidence is there, isn't it? Because it's there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, so that's why we're leaning on that. We are leaning on that Ruth situation at the moment. What was her last name? So Ruth?
Perry.
What that surname was? Perry, yeah. So I was kind of in a position like, if they change the law because of that, what's rightly so, then that will, as we know, health and safety law changes across every industry, doesn't it then? And that is a catalyst. And I always find, again, looking, I know, feeling sorry for myself and for construction workers, they say there was 507 of these cases in 2021, and not many people outside of construction know that. That's the numbers that we're actually looking at, and that was 2021. And I think there was a report last week come out from last year, wasn't it? I think suicide's gone up in general in the previous years. I don't think it's been categorised to construction.
So that means in construction, you are statistically more likely to take your own life than die as a result of a work-related accident.
Oh, yeah. Last year went up from, I think on average it was about 32 a year, and then last year there was 45 deaths on site just through injuries. But there was 500 obviously suicides the year before, so it's like over 10 times the amount of chance of you dying from suicide.
Am I right in thinking, Steve, that some of these, I'm sure I've read something along the way saying that in some cases of these suicides they're actually taking their lives at work?
Yes. Yeah, 100%. So I the ones that there's four that I know this happened at work. And the rest, a lot of them are in general, but that doesn't, I think there's still a lot there. I reckon there's a hell of a lot there that aren't taken into consideration. So you're looking at the odd plasterer or the odd chippy here and there who does the odd private jobs for people or little jobs in the little places. And he's not part of big teams and he's just known as a general hand, really. So there's probably a hell of a lot more, scarily, but yeah, it's happening on the site, on the biggest project.
Then that creates a massive issue as well, doesn't it? Because suddenly now you've still got to, if it's happening in work, you've got the well-being of your workers you've got to cope with, because they're not. I mean, even if you've got a mental health first aider, they're not going to know what to do if there's some body there right in front of them.
Exactly.
I mean, that must be horrendous for them as well.
The thing with it, the industry doesn't learn from this because the industry brushes all this under the carpet. And the only people that know about that, the people on that site, and nobody ever really goes to the press with it or talks about it publicly. There's no safety alerts about the dangers or risks of a suicide on site.
It's sad because Ruth Perry made national headlines and she's a head teacher.
Yeah,
That says a lot, doesn't it? Value to society, is seen differently, as you said before.
Yeah. If we get a flurry of emails or inquiries from big companies that we do, and we have done in the last 3-4 weeks, we know that there's been something. You can tell. It's like I've got a little boy. You know when something's up, when he's acting differently. And you can tell within people when they act different that something's up. We've literally got 4 or 5 major contractors come to us about doing some work with them this summer. And yeah, it sounds fantastic to us, but I'm like, there's something to that. And I found out, 4 weeks ago, someone took their own life right in the city on a building site, as in London, it's London City kind of quarter. And like I say, I was fortunate enough to have a BBC program a few years back. It's now on YouTube, on our YouTube channel. You can see it on there, a little plug. But off the back of that, we had a huge amount of influx of people coming to us who aren't in construction because they didn't have a clue just how bad a state we're in. But when you look at, it's not just the suicide side of it, it's trauma. And I've said this to a few people in the past, and I've heard it from a lot of people. But when you're in the military, and they obviously have suffered massively over the years, and I completely get that and fully respect, but there's an element of getting in the military where you go to war and you understand the dangers and risks and you know what's going to potentially be coming. But then the same with the fire brigade and the blue light services. You will go to a call out and you will be given a heads up on what you're about to go and see. So like the fire brigade would be alerted if they're going to a road traffic collision. And they will be made aware of X amount of people involved, these people on the scene, this is what you're facing. So they're going into a situation a little bit prepared. When someone gets taken out by a 30-ton digger or hit or run over by a dump truck, nobody is prepared for that. Construction workers don't go to work to understand how to deal with trauma. And these other emergency services to have an element of training to deal with that. We aren't trained in that way. And then we had one in Aldermaston last year, Balfour Beatty job. Jay Coffees were working over there. We're working for them. And a guy got killed by a concrete pump, cleaning out the concrete pump. And pressure in the pump that he went, and the pump just disengaged, and I think took the guy's life. And nobody on that site was made. Well, I've heard differently from the powers that be at the top because they spoke to me, not realizing that my team were on that job. They said everybody was dealt with respectively. We weren't even paid for the stand down time. We're still £2,000 short on the stand down time that we didn't get paid for on that job. And our guys weren't once asked, "Are you okay? Do you know the guy that was on site yesterday with you isn't here anymore?" like our guys didn't see it firsthand because they left about 20 minutes before, but they didn't go back to that job after that. And that's Balfour Beatty washing their hands of us, really, on that job with the people who were there. But there's so many cases of that. I've seen stuff. I worked on the Crossrail for 4 or 5 years. And when you're working on the train lines 4 or 5 years, you see a lot, a hell of a lot that you don't want to see. All walks of life, things that you don't realise go on in life. And you see the aftermath of people who make these decisions. And not once did we get... There was one time, Gidea Park Station and Harold Wood Station both needed work done. I literally flipped the coin with a mate of mine. He went to Harold Wood, I went to Gidea Park, just like East London / Essex. And we're on the M25. He witnessed a suicide there and then, and he got phoned up. And even in my head, I started thinking, God, I could have seen that. I was nearly there, thank God I weren't. But he was asked, do you want to have tomorrow off and a couple of days off to get your head just a bit of downtime? And he literally said, I'm not going to do that because I won't get paid. And they went, okay, no worries, see you in the morning. Jesus. And that was it. And he was straight back to work. But when someone, I've dealt with a lot of heavy civils works as well, and we're digging deep excavations. I've not seen it firsthand, but I've got a very close friend of mine who's been there as a first responder in the fire brigade. But when a trench collapse and has taken someone's life. But what happens is that trench doesn't get re-diverted to a safer route. All they do is clean it out, get the guy, the body, shall we say, remove the person, take away the situation. Investigation will go on. In 2-3 weeks' time, guess what? His mates are coming back and they're going to carry on that job, knowing full well that you look at but when you actually look at the real truth of it, is they will, his best mates, his colleagues that were next to him in the van, will carry on digging that trench as soon as that site's back open, knowing full well that trench took their mate's life. And then someone says, well, there's a mental health first aider up in the office somewhere you can go and talk to you about your feelings.
There's some random lady in the office who you have no idea, go and talk to this complete stranger who you might be a bit concerned, might tell everybody about your innermost feelings and thoughts.
I worked with a guy on nights, and I said to him that one of us can go, we were both foremen on night shifts, and I said that one of us can go on days in a couple of weeks. I said, I don't really mind, mate. I said, I'm pretty easy. I didn't have kids at the time. I was fairly flexible. The rates didn't change too much. And his words to me as a 50, 60-year-old man was, Steve, I don't do nights. I don't do day shifts. I only work the nights. And I've been like that for 20 years and I'm not changing. And he was quite uptight to it towards me. I went, that's fine. I said, I'll do the day shift. It doesn't matter. And then I just pushed him. I said, why are you so anti days? And the reason was because he can't sleep in the dark. And that is, he said, and then when I got to know him, he witnessed a fatality 30 years ago. And if he sleeps in the dark, he wakes up smelling what he smelled that day. God. And that was kind of...
That's horrendous.
And he's been like that for 30 years. He gets through the weekends because he has his family and kids, and he has a good few... And he literally said, I'll have a good drink up on the weekend and that'll get me through the night. He said, but during the week, I can't sleep in the dark. He has to sleep when the sun's up.
That's just horrendous. And I was horrendous.
Like, that for him was normal life. He didn't... But an eyelid
now on your Construction Sport website, you actually have things like help in information with things like insomnia, bipolar, eating disorders, all sorts of different information on there as well. So if anybody is affected by any of this and wants to talk or wants to find out some information, have a look on the constructionsport.com website, go to the help section. And the great thing, what I like about what you've done with this, you and your team, Steve, is that you've then linked lots of other support systems, but not just for, it could be kids, it could be under 18s as well. It's, there's a lot of information on here, which I think is really useful. You've done a really good job of collating these bits of information. So I think kudos to you and your team for pulling all of that together, because there's a lot of really useful stuff on there.
Yeah, we tried, and for all my sins, and some people don't do it. I really don't mind failing at things. And one thing we have done in the past is look at different ways that we can support people. And as a charity, we're in place to support Signpost. So we're not here to give direct therapy or support or psychiatry to people, psychological help. But what we did try was an employee assistance program where companies sign up and then they then get an EAP platform and then this and that. But we just couldn't get construction workers on it because they couldn't. It was hard to speak to a company and say you'll be priced on X amount of people or you'll be priced on this way. That's why we literally just went with £100 per company for everyone. And we will try and make our website over time like a free EAP platform for everyone. So people can just go and get help without having to log into anything. You can literally be one or two clicks away from a potential a number.
Yeah,
that can
and that's
help
really
you.
Useful because
and we are over time.
Sometimes now, it's hard, I guess, yeah. for businesses that don't have mental health first aiders or like you don't think they're very beneficial. Actually, having all that information there on you know on one website is so handy, I think, because there's so much on here. You've got so many different, you know, you've got, like I say, depression, anxiety, gambling, insomnia, obsessive compulsive disorders, phobias, schizophrenia, stress, all sorts of loads of information. So I think it's a really good port of call if anybody wants to find out more information. And there's loads of links to then different charitable organizations and support systems. So I think that's great. I really think that's super, super useful for either managers who just want to learn more about those subjects, or perhaps, as you say, for people who are struggling themselves, maybe even, you know, and want to know where to go. Because sometimes the GP option isn't always, I mean, my sister's a GP, so I know how GPs struggle and would love to be able to give us much more of their time, but they just haven't got the capacity. I mean, the practice that my sister works at, I think there's two full-time GPs and 25,000 patients. How that's even legal, I've got no idea. But it's just, you know, so therefore these charitable organizations, we literally would collapse without charity in the UK. So no, it's a great, great website. Well done to you and all your team for putting that together. It's really fantastic.
Thank you. We're trying to add to it weekly, adding to it. We're also trying to do as well with when the cameras come is each of those topics have just general conversations around them as well. Because what we notice with the media, and that's why we went as a charity, it's not really a thing. What charities do is do online strategies and stuff. We notice that. But with construction, if you want to be in touch with the construction workforce, look at what they're doing when they're on a team on their tea breaks and they are on their phones. And that is literally where we realise that if we want to be in front of these construction workers, like I can go to a site and they're paying mad money, really, and I'm not for it. So for me to go in and talk about my story on site to as many people as possible, but I just come up with the idea, so that why would I go to a site and talk to 20 people if I could talk to a camera and that goes out to 1,000 people? In terms of as a charity, we need to be seen at the numbers that we can hit and how far we can push our message. And that's the reason why we're kind of going to do the online thing. We're speaking to a few companies at the moment about doing stuff on site and stuff. And I do love it. That's obviously where we have a great crack on site. But in terms of getting the message
maybe
out
maybe you should look at developing your own version of the mental health first aid course, you know, but the construction sport spin on it maybe.
Funny to say that. I've literally got a PowerPoint half of what I'm going through, a desk PowerPoint, but I'm trying to do it differently. We're looking at different ways to do it because I always say we're not educated in classrooms, especially myself. But it is along those lines of more of an open conversation for a couple of hours, getting people talking about it, but obviously almost in a construction sport way. So as we've mentioned as well, talking about Johnny Wilkinson and the mind behind him and these ultra successful people who look like they've just been given these talents, but actually when you actually look into it, these people have come through some real tough stuff and trying to show people that you're not the only one out there. And that's what we've done a lot of walks. We do a lot of walks. We get out with lots of groups of people and when you go on them walks, that's when you start to realise, think, Christ, I'm not the only one who's in this position then. And I know from personal experience, when you're in a dark place, that you really feel like you're the only one in the world in a dark place. And I think, but people need to snap out of it a little bit and realise they're not on their own with it, really. And that's kind of where we are until we change riddles.
Well, Steve, I've got to say, I appreciate your time today. I found it really, really interesting. And I just know our listeners will as well, because I've got a bit of a measure of them. It's probably like the same with your YouTubers. You get the measure of your audience, don't you, a little bit? And I know that they will find this really interesting. And I know that they will be jumping onto your website and having a look. And I would definitely recommend them too. And of course, any of the construction companies or anybody involved in construction who's listening, you know, can maybe consider that the 100 Club. I think it would be it's a good place to start. If you're not sure where to start, it's a good place to start, I think, isn't it? It's like making that pledge, that commitment that I don't know the answer. We don't know everything. We're not sure if this is going to work, but you've got to start somewhere with this, isn't it? And that's, you know, taking those first steps to try and support your workforce a little bit better, I think. So that would be a good point.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there, because that's literally what we said to the companies that work with us. We're like, you guys don't know where to start. We don't know where to start with a membership basis, but we're all in this together. And if we can all support, then I think that one thing that's come off the back of COVID, I really think, is the actual power, what is within communities. And I think how important communities are for people, whether that in a workplace community or a personal community. Just when you look at anything, groups of friends, hobbies, interests, everything that get you by day to day, all normally is based around the community. Yeah, just trying to promote that, really, and bring our own community together.
Thank
you.
And thank you for taking the time to talk to me today. I'm much appreciated.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me as a guest. I love doing the podcast side of things. And yeah, keep up your work as well. I'll keep listening, because I'll be pushing it out and saying a little message out this afternoon to everyone.
A bit of mutual love.
And have a listen, because there you go. It's nice to be nice.
Do you know, I think it does. It makes you happy being nice. It's a knock-on effect.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much again, listeners, and thank you to Steve, and you all take care of one another.
Take care.